Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Studying Media Critically, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm your host, Gummer Clare, and today I'm joined by Danveer Singh Bra, who's a lecturer in Black British History at the University of Leeds. We'll be talking about his book, Tech Life, Ghettoville, Esky, The Sonic Ecologies of Black Music in the Early 21st Century, which was published in 2021. Welcome to the show, Danveer.
Thanks for having me, Gummer. Glad to be on.
So I guess could we start with you telling us a little bit about your academic and professional background?
I'm a regular listener and subscriber to various New Books Networks channels, and this question always throws me a bit because it feels like you're in a job interview, and I don't know how to answer it without kind of giving that sort of, you know, answer where you try and convey yourself to be a really competent and adequate professional. But I guess one way into that question would be to say that there are a set of kind of concerns, questions, commitments, obsessions that kind of shape a lot of the research that I'm involved in and try to produce. One would be the political aesthetics of Black diasporic music, stretching from, I guess, the post-war period to the present. And usually the way I enter that is through Black diasporic popular music in North America, Britain and the Caribbean. Another way into the kind of set of research agendas that I'm trying to take up is the relationship between the question of race in critical and cultural, I guess the question of race in intellectual activity and intellectual politics. And then thirdly, I'd say it's a broader concern with the cultural politics of race. So the intersection of race and cultural studies. So they're the main things that that kind of determine the parameters of the research I do. But in generally, it's kind of following various obsessions, various interests around a set of questions about how people have sought to respond to and change the situations in which they find themselves, and how they respond to and change those situations aesthetically, culturally, and paying attention to those practices, those manifestations.
And I mean, those questions all really animate much of this book, but I guess could you tell us a little bit about what drew you to write this book specifically, and the musics that you choose here?
The book was a kind of an accident, really. You could say it's a kind of an organization of an accident. I fell into it in many ways. The work I'd done as a PhD was really focused on trying to think about the aesthetics and politics of sound in the context of Black radicalism in the US during the 60s. So, you know, I tried to put together these comparative analyses of particular moments of kind of sonic intensity that appear in the spheres of music or politics broadly conceived. So like James Brown, Amiri Baraka, Martin Luther King and Sam Cooke and Motown and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. But all the while when I was working on that material in my, you could call my non-formal research life, I was, you know, just pursuing my own interests and obsessions and my own desires for electronic music, various forms of electronic dance music that have been there since I was a teenager. And really, I guess, looking at it retrospectively, in the PhD, I was working out a set of methods for trying to think about how to think about music in different ways, in ways that I found kind of satisfying. And once I finished the PhD, I guess, as a result of the regularity of you know, going to dances, listening to music, talking about it continuously with friends, that I started to put together some notes, some ideas, particularly on footwork and grime. And the book just kind of grew and developed from there. And I pretty much decided quite quickly that I didn't want to go for a PhD to book conversion path, because I'd kind of finished with that project in the PhD stage. I like to try and keep a kind of element of freshness to anything I'm doing. So the book really just grew out of there. Several years of engaging with the music of the artists and the styles that I focus on in that book, footwork, grime, and actress. And then, as I say at the end of the book could have taken many manifestations, alternative manifestations, depending on the choices I made about what would end up in the final version of the book. But what I decided once the book started to appear and come into view is that there was something about the questions of urbanism and space that were unifying the particular artists and styles that I focus on in the book. So I thought, let's just stick with that. It's got a level of coherency to it. It looks like it's pre-planned, it's been thought through, even though it's kind of after the fact. So let's go with that and work with that. And yeah, that's really where the book kind of came out of. A kind of formalization intensification of a kind of a long period of leisure activity, I guess.
And so, as you say, the three musics you look at are grime, footwork, and the music of the producer actress. And the book opens with this fantastic little portrait where you describe some of the sonic characteristics of one specific track from each of those three. For listeners who might not be aware, could you maybe lay out some of the distinctive sonic features of the three musics?
Yeah. Wow, that's because I haven't even looked at the book really since I handed it over to the publishers, and I haven't gone back to that music so much, apart from the launch. I guess footwork is one mistake often made about footwork is that it's thought to be music that is very fast, but instead it's intense, and there's a difference between speed and intensity. And its intensity comes from actually the way it presses together lots of contrasting elements. One would be this kind of this rapid snare drum pattern, which is where the impression of its speed comes from, which moves a high velocity. But then that's combined usually in with two other elements. The other is this kind of sharp, punching kind of bass line that comes underneath, the kind of that draws on the genealogies of Chicago house. And the third is usually some sort of sample, whether it's from contemporary R&B, it could be some element of kind of 70s, even 60s soul, or it could be a sample ripped from a particular hip hop track. And then maybe there's a fourth element in footwork, which is the presence of a producer, usually kind of verbalizing over the in snippets over the top of a track. With grime, God, yeah, grime. That's a really tough one. Grime is like sharp, highly synthetic, has very high rates of propulsion. It feels like both like a kind of expulsion of air, release of pressure, but also it sounds like kind of bits of metal grinding up against each other. But there's a very different styles of grime under the grime umbrella, but there tends to be staccato bass drums, often sometimes in grime tracks there aren't much in the isn't much in the way of bass activity, but really the point of grime, or the way that grime functions, is as a means to stimulate performances from MCs. So what you've got is a very complex, synthetic, sharp soundscape in which MCs can therefore test their skills. So rather than providing a bedrock or a background for an MC's skills, it's almost often as if the MC, as much as battling with each other, are battling with the soundscape of the production. With actresses' music, well, that's the root. That's probably the toughest one, because under the actress banner, he has a wide range of kind of, I guess you call it, production guises. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say one of the ways to describe actresses is something like a combination of Chicago house, New Jack Swing, and Detroit techno, but as if you were listening to it through in the smoking area of a club. So you're listening to it at a kind of, I wouldn't call it a distance, but a level of kind of filter and abstraction. And it's very much as if he's looking down over the top of the music and playing and toying with bits of it, I would say, with actress. But I guess one of the differences and one of the common discussions I've had as a result of the book is the difference between seeing actress DJ and hearing his productions, because his productions often present a very intricate style of music. But if you've seen him DJ, often the few occasions I've seen him DJ, he has an extremely intense, distorted approach to DJing, which I think gives you a different perspective on what he's doing on record.
I suppose that distinction between production and the performance of a production is also quite key in all of these musics that you look at, which I guess we'll come to in a little bit. So before we move into the kind of the meat of the book, I thought it might be a good idea to ask you about two concepts that recur throughout the book, which is the idea of sonic ecology and phonomateriality. So what do these terms mean? And could you maybe talk a little bit about the theoretical underpinnings of the concepts and the body of literature the book is situating itself within?
Yeah, sure. I was kind of wary of trying to present the book as a kind of invention of new concepts. I think that kind of drive for novelty is quite dangerous in academic or intellectual life at present. Often what you get in publishing, I think, is a trademark in the attempt to trademark concepts rather than publish books. And I tend to prefer to work on the idea that no one arrives at anything kind of purely original. You know, that you've borrowed things and you've adapted them. So the idea of sonic ecology is really borrowed from two or three kind of places. One obvious place would be, it appears in Steve Goodman's book, Sonic Warfare. And one of the regular experiences which fed into the thinking around the book was going to the several hyperdub parties that Steve was running as part of his label that he and he DJs under the name Code 9. But also you can see something like sonic ecology appear in under different names appear in the writing and thinking of Catherine McKittrick and Abdul Malik Simone, who are both geographers, but seem to think their approach to geography and particularly urbanism through the manifestations of various types of Black diasporic music. So that's really where sonic ecology is coming from. And phonomateriality is a kind of borrowing and adaptation from a term that Fred Moten uses at the start of In the Break, and that once you identify it there, you kind of spot it in several places. This, in a way, what I think phonomateriality allows for is a way to pay attention to music as organized sound and the aesthetics of that organized sound without having to go through the particular mechanics and techniques of musicology, which I'm not trained in, so I wouldn't be able to. But also as a way of avoiding what, you know, in some instances is often the trap of cultural studies, which a cultural studies approach to music, which tends to leave the actual sonic material aside in its analysis. So yeah, that's once you spot it as phrono materiality, it kind of appears everywhere in Baraka, in Gilroy, in Alexander Wahile, Richard Eyton, you know, obviously in McKittrick, who I just mentioned. You know, it appears almost anywhere and everywhere in the writing of Greg Tate. You know, it's all over the place. Once you identify it as such or give it a particular name, it's always been there. It's just a name for a thing that's always been in operation, I'd say.
And that connection of the contents of the sound to the social and to the production of the social and the spatial is obviously very central in all those authors that you cite, and you know, again, animates much of the book itself, I think. So then in chapter one, you kind of lay some groundwork for your three case studies by discussing the earlier emergence of black electronic dance music, specifically focusing on house, techno and jungle. But you're clear that you're not just trying to draw a kind of straight line connecting these earlier forms to footwork, grime and actress. Instead, you're making a much more subtle point here about what you call the changing same of black electronic dance music, obviously from Baraka. Can you explain that phrase and how it relates to what jungle, house and techno can show us about the entanglement of music, race, class and territory at the end of the 20th century?
Yeah, I mean, the changing same is, yeah, it's a term that first appears in Baraka, and it's in Baraka's usage. It's a very kind of potent and productive way to think, to give a name for what he thinks of as the metaphysical project of black diasporic music, which is a kind of complication of what it could be understood as the modernist drive towards the new or new horizons. And Baraka says, well, in the case of black diasporic music, you get this complication, disruption of that modernist impulse by the fact that you get a constant push to develop new forms of the music. But what happens in that push towards new forms is that some fragments of the past are always reworked. And therefore you get this idea of the changing same of black music, that nothing is ever a complete break from the past. That something of, whether it's historical memory or musical memory, is always carried over and readapted, and that's, as again, as you pointed out, that's not to say there are strict genealogies. It's about how you listen and how you pay attention to that changing same. And yeah, the relationship between jungle, house and techno, and then footwork, grime and the actress's music is, yeah, I'm not looking to develop, to say there's a strict line of transference here. It's more to do with the sets of conditions in which they emerge that are comparable, often because they're in the same place, but also it's their approach to materials, whether those are musical materials or what we call social materials. There seems to be, it's more of a kind of structural approach, I'd say. There seems to be something structural in the way that you could say that Chicago house, techno and jungle, as you could call them the formative moments of contemporary dance music production, a possible set of starting points, that in those starting points they set up some terms, ways of working, that I think if you understand those, you can therefore start to see how those ways of working, those structural conditions, are played out and reworked and adapted in contemporary situations, in current situation, and in different settings as well.
And I think having that kind of that scene setting makes so much sense for then kind of going into the subsequent music. So you build on this, and moving into the following chapter, you talk about trying to theorize the blackness of black electronic music. Again, I know we've done a bit of kind of defining terms, but it feels quite important to unpack what blackness means in the sense that you're using it here and then throughout the book.
In a way, that's part of the question, that's the question that stimulates the project and is ultimately left unanswered unanswered because it's part of that changing same dynamic. But if, yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say in that chapter is black music is, black music has to be thought through its historical conditions of production. And those historical conditions of production would be the, you know, the facts of slavery and colonization as the defining experiences for the existence of that music. But also that the music as a, let's say, a social and philosophical endeavor is trying to rethink and constantly change and break, make bids for freedom out of that. And that's where something, you might get something like the question of blackness appear, pop up in black music. That I don't, the question of blackness of black music is a product of processes of racialization, violent processes of racialization, but it's not reducible to them. And I think that's what I'm trying to set up in that chapter, saying that actually that this has been an ongoing debate, an ongoing set of ideas at work in black diasporic intellectual practice, and that actually the thinkers who have paid closest attention to the music have been trying to tap into and unpack this question. And those debates are unstable. They're not, there's not a clear set of kind of camps. Those questions aren't resolved in any particular way, but they seem to be what keeps the thinking about the music going, as well as the music itself, I would suggest. And actually the a lot of the people that whose ideas I kind of rip and borrow from would, I think, suggest the same.
Building on that, I think one really interesting concept that comes through there is about a drive toward unrecognizability in black musical experimentation. And that felt really significant, the way that you were using it there. So what's that doing as a concept, and how does it maybe call into question ideas of black music as being straightforwardly representational or realist?
Yeah. I mean, that was actually what attracted me to these particular musical forms to write about, in terms of styles or projects to write about and develop for the purposes of a book. And actually, as it tends to be the thing that draws me towards musical forms or aesthetic projects in general, that that attempt to produce an effect or a type of unrecognizability, yet still making a claim on a set of conditions. So I think it's undeniable that footwork is black music, right? There are a set of quite obvious features and factors which say, okay, yeah, no, you could say concretely it's black music, but what it's doing is it's rendering our acceptable ideas or historically constituted ideas of what black music is or isn't, it's rendering them unstable. And I think that's what makes these musics exciting. But if you start to listen closely, listen attentively, and you listen to what the artists are telling you, or not telling me in this instance, but what they say about their own music practice, is that there is something of the past, is something of a kind of history, historical knowledge, historical attitude buried in there. You just have to listen out for it. And I think they're kind of challenging the way we historicize, and the way we categorize. So that's, yeah, I think that's certainly the case with footwork. Often the early reception of it, particularly in the UK, was you know, this music sounds like, in a very positive sense, out there, you know, kind of, it's really, I don't know how best to describe it, but it's frenetic, it sounds almost unlistenable. But as people start to write and think about it more and start to speak to the artist more, they can begin to situate what it's doing and where it's coming from. Exactly the same goes with grime. When people first heard grime, it was like this kind of nuclear explosion had gone off. And it was quite, in a very real sense, a leap. Taking a set of kind of musical styles, approaches that had been developing over a number of years and building for a number of years, and it suddenly takes them and flips everything and takes a sharp turn, a kind of handbrake turn in another direction. And it seems like everything has been left, previously has been left behind. But again, if you listen closely, you can hear what you can hear what's been adapted, which is not to say they're referencing the past, but you can hear traces of what's been adapted. I think actually that's at the heart of Actress's project from the outset, this attempt to render the familiar strange, or render the familiar unrecognizable, or at least appear to kind of, I guess, in some sense, the producer challenging themselves, but also challenging the listener, the dancer, to listen differently.
You touched on it there in passing about you saying, you know, not you actually speaking to the artist. And so that feels like quite a conscious kind of, I guess, methodological choice that you, despite having, you know, lots of, as you're saying, experience of going to these shows, going to these dances, you've quite explicitly chosen not to do interviews or not to do ethnography, really. Could you maybe expand on your kind of choice of approach for this and basing it much more in a kind of, yeah, critical listening and then theoretical approach?
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to treat the materials produced by these artists as artworks, and that's the first approach I take to them, and then everything kind of follows from there. And it poses challenges because, you know, at best you might have something like an album in the case of footwork, possibly in grime. Obviously, in the case in Actress's output, you have a lot of albums or EP works. But really, especially in footwork and grime, you have a lot of unstable, ephemeral material. So how do you treat this as an artistic practice and think about its aesthetics without having something stable to fix upon? And that actually, I think, is what draws me towards treating them as artworks. And in that sense, I would say I'm treating them as artworks because to me they're evidence of they're singular instances of collectivized intellectual activity. I, you know, there's great value. There probably would have been great value in going to speak to grime MCs, going to speak with Actress, or speak with, you know, Rashad and Spin. On odd occasions I have, but not as a result of this project. It's just, you know, happens to be a chance meeting and just talking to them, or maybe in the kind of, you know, at the bar of a club or something like that. But it's not been a kind of concerted research endeavor. But really to say, well, they're making the music and they're making it for a reason to, in one sense, in a to speak to the wider world. So let's listen to the music and try and unpack what it is they're trying to say. They're using the music as their primary means of communication and expression. So why not pay close attention to what they're doing in the music and trying to kind of unpack that as best you can. And, you know, it's a gambit. I'm not making a set of indisputable claims. It's an argument. There are a set of propositions, but it's more about, well, let's take this seriously as intellectual activity. And if you do, what difference might that open up in terms of thinking about this musical, these musical projects, rather than relying on what tends to be often can be the approach to black musical forms, particularly, you know, urban musical forms, to go and speak to the artist as a kind of lends an assurance of authenticity, which again, that if you go back to the unrecognizability thesis, is not really, I'm not looking for that sort of anchor. You know, if an artist wants to disagree with what I've written, that's fine, you know, that's cool. It's not a problem. I mean, like, I'd be happy that they read it, you know. I'd just be happy that they read it. If they want to disagree, that's totally fine. It's not an issue.
Cool. Well, maybe you can anticipate some emails after this podcast. So yeah, turning to your analysis of footwork, could you explain the relationship between dancers and producers in making this music and why this matters for your kind of theoretical position?
Yeah, well, what happens with footwork is, you know, a very acute and compressed manifestation of something that had always been in existence in Chicago House, or seems to have been in existence from Chicago House from very early on, and the various guises that Chicago House went through from the 80s onwards, is this tendency towards coordinated competitive dancing. Particularly once you get to Ghetto House, there is some element of organized dancing and competitive dancing between groups of people in club spaces from, you know, again, the bits of history that I put together, the more detailed histories of Chicago House, the oral histories that you can put together. But what happens with footwork is two things. One, the dance battle moves out of the club and goes into the either the open air of the ghettoized area of Chicago, or in particular social spaces like kind of community centers or school gyms or just abandoned buildings or something along those lines. And secondly, what starts to happen from what I was able to piece together from about the genealogy of footwork is that as a result of these kind of specialized dance battles that take place, the dancers start to make a demand upon producers to have increasingly complex rhythms to dance to in order to test their dancing capacities. I think what this intensification of what had been in existence for a long time as an informal, I guess, practice in Chicago, what it leads to is this thing we call footwork, whereby the dancers and producers seem to be making the music together in a very direct, overt way. Whereas, you know, you could argue the condition of all electronic dance music or dance music involves some exchange between dancers and producers, because, you know, producers are testing out materials at dances. They see how dancers respond. If there isn't that much of a positive response, they'll go away and rework it or try something else. And that's the way it tends to operate, you know, across the board, no matter which kind of genre or style you're looking at. But in Chicago, that gets really kind of put together in a very particular way, in a very overt way, and it's very difficult, therefore, to listen to footwork without, in a way, hearing the dancers' movements. Right? It's a kind of got a cross media. It's kind of got an element of bleed across media, built into footwork. You've got the visual element, the choreographic element of the dancers' movements, and then you've got they're kind of being folded in and embedded into the sonic palette of the music, and vice versa. That it becomes almost indivisible.
And I suppose a question that came to mind when I was thinking about this, because I remember first coming across footwork, watching kind of YouTube videos that showed the dancing and the music at once, and they felt, you know, so inseparable, as you talk about. But since then, as you kind of already mentioned, you know, footwork's had quite a lot of uptake in certain kind of European circles. And I know that quite a lot of footwork DJs often end up on the bills of European kind of avant-garde festivals or whatever. What happens to a music that's so intensely, you know, related to a certain space and a certain set of movements and interactions when it moves into like the European concert hall?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a question that's been for a long time on for various underground folk popular music forms, right? But in this instance, I mean, someone who I find really interesting on this is DJ Spin. He's quite been overt about it. He says that, look, the what he produces and plays, particularly him and Rashad when they were working together before Rashad passed, what they play for the European audience was this hybrid version of footwork that they were adapting and developing that they felt would lend itself to club spaces where people were firstly, because the first way in which footwork entered Europe was through club nights that would play to the palates and ears of bodies of European dancers in Europe. And that's a kind of very broad term, because you've got, you know, the type of social ecology of dancing in the UK is going to be different to Berlin or Italy or whatever, depending on the histories of electronic music in those particular countries. So they were already attuned to that. But also, you know, there's the real everyday basic element is they're working musicians, you know, and you go where the work is. And they were able to sustain themselves by tapping into this energy for what they were doing in firstly clubs in Europe, and then as you pointed out, like various kind of arts festivals across, you know, European cities. Yeah, one argument you could make is that there's been an element of dilution. I guess that's fair. But then there's also, you know, going back to the changing same argument, that music's constantly developing. And you perhaps wouldn't have, you know, the kind of really fascinating deviations from a central footwork palette that you get in producers such as Jay Lynn or kind of, you know, the albums that RP Boo's been putting out. So I think it's, you know, I don't think you need to, again, kind of have some claim over authenticity that one instance of footwork is more authentic than the other. It's developed the way it has, and we wouldn't be encountering it. We wouldn't be here talking about it if it hadn't been able to, they hadn't been, you know, the musicians themselves, the producers themselves hadn't been thinking, right, so there's this interest in, you know, these club nights in London. What is it they're listening to there? What is it they're attuned to there? And how can we present our music in a way which meets them and welcomes them in to footwork? You know, and I think that's something that I would actually applaud.
You also highlight the widespread use of the term tech with a K by those involved in making the music. What for you is the significance of this term, and what does it tell us about the blackness of footwork?
To me, that's the invention and use of this term tech is that collectivized social intellectual activity at work. That's the evidence of it. It's a kind of organic intellectual activity, you know, to use a more accepted term, at work. It's them not only making their music, but them thinking about, or what are the particular qualities of our music, and what is it we want it to, how do we want to convey it to the world? And it seems to, because, you know, it's tech, it's not so much the term tech in and of itself, the way the term tech is used in conjunction with other terms, combined with other words, used as part of the invention of other neologisms, so architecture, tech life, technician. And that seems to, those terms in themselves seem to imply something of the fact they see themselves as, in a way, a kind of post-industrial laborers. The idea of being a technician, of having a craft. But it's tech with a K, so it has this kind of post-industrial feel to it, this speculative feel to it. But it's also very much of a place, right? It's saying we're not only building music, but we seem to be trying to build place, or build an idea of place in the music. So I think the term tech is, I guess, in a way, it's telling you something about the way race is being made and refused, and in the particular context in which that music is being made.
Yeah, that's the making and refusal. That's a really nice way of putting it, I think. And could you explain what you see as some of the issues with urban sociology with regard to black life in Chicago, and the way that footwork kind of enacts a critique of theories of urban decay and ghettoization?
That was the bit of the chapter that was, I wouldn't say toughest, but it was just kind of like having to delve into a set of debates that I had a sense that were there, but I hadn't realized how extensive they were and how deep they were. And there was a stage in which, you know, I kind of go, well, how deep, like, this is an ongoing debate in the field of urban sociology. Two kind of debates in the field of urban sociology. One is, how do you define the urban? I guess it would make it three debates. It seems to me, anyway. One, how you define the urban. Two, how you define the ghetto. And three, how come Chicago seems to be the template for all of this thinking about the urban and the ghetto, or at least the starting point for it. And there's no way in which, you know, I would say that the summary and the entry I have into those debates is definitive. And I'm sure people who have a much deeper schooling in these debates will be able to point out, you know, the kind of flaws in my argument. But it's built on a basic premise. There seemed to be from the materials that I'd read and kind of surveyed, there seemed to be a claim that, okay, what starts to happen in the 1990s is you get the development of a certain type of life in urban environments in Chicago, as emblematic of urban environments across America, whereby there's a kind of like structural desolation that comes into play, you know, due to the abandonment of these areas by the state, the movement of a black bourgeoisie out of ghettoized areas, the wider structural shifts in capital that produces this element of a kind of what seems to be the tendency to think of these places as desolated and, you know, in need of some sort of implication, being that needs some sort of rescuing or help. And you can kind of, in some sense, you can kind of see where they're coming from. But at the same time, then you go, oh, well, if you accept that argument, then how do you explain the fact that at the very same time, let's say in Chicago, these claims are being made, there's this huge flourishing of ghetto house and the development of what was known in amongst house fans as one of the Motowns of Chicago, ghetto house, the Dance Mania label. How is this flourishing of cultural activity, of expressive sonic activity? How do those two things sit together? And all I was trying to do in that section is say, well, how do we deal with this? Because, you know, these two things don't seem to cohere. How can you have on one side this set of claims that there's been a destruction of a certain type of, a certain vision, a certain type of black social life in Chicago, and at the same time, there's this rapid flourishing of musical activity? How do those sit together? And that's kind of the question I was trying to pose, is that if you're saying that term is from, I think it's from Loic Wacquant, that the Chicago ghetto is now nothing but a warehouse for discarded material, I think I might be misremembering that. You're like, well, if it is, then where's footwork coming from? And perhaps that tells us about something about, you know, what we think of as a warehouse, what we think of as discarded material. That there's, you know, materials and peoples we might think of as waste or wasted or desolate might have something going on there which we're not paying attention to, that we're not attuned to.
Yeah, totally. I suppose the warehouse in particular there being quite specific.
Exactly, yeah.
Given its relevance.
Yeah, that was a big light bulb moment, yeah.
Yeah. So then moving on to chapter 4, where you discuss the actress's music, you're particularly attentive to his relationship to kind of abstraction and the everyday, and how this work is like often quite a long way removed from, say, like the quite sci-fi inflicted speculation of like techno. So could you talk a little bit about the productive tension you identify between abstraction and the kind of firm grounding in the immediate environment that you see in Ghettoville and in Actress's work?
The stuff on Actress, I mean, I really wanted to make sure it stayed in there. I was in discussions with editors. There was a feeling often that the Actress chapter is a kind of anomaly, because firstly, it's focused on a singular artist and built around a singular album. But secondly, that because of the particular overtly, you could call in some sense, it's not the right term because I think this is a problematic term, but let's say the for want of a better term, the overtly cerebral presentation of Actress's music, that it doesn't seem to sit with you know, the idea or the preconceived idea of what grime and tech life are doing. But what I enjoyed about, what I found productive about Actress's music, and what I liked about it in terms of its unrecognizability, is that he was clearly drawing upon a set of ideas or attitudes, a set of sensibilities I think he'd identified a strain or a certain kind of sensibility or strain in the musical forms that he was attracted to. And he'd pulled that out and made them into his own type of sound. And that would be this tendency towards abstraction that he hears in Chicago House, New Jack Swing, obviously Prince, and Detroit Techno. But what he doesn't try and do is make these retro projects, right? He doesn't try to say, well, how do I make my music sound like this music from the past that I'm influenced by? How do I use the impulses of that music, this strain of abstraction that I've identified, but make something that's speaking to what it is that I want to express and say about our present? And that's where I kind of try to carve out this idea, because in the writing about Detroit techno in particular, you know, there's a now accepted narrative which, you know, the artists put forward themselves, which is Detroit techno, and particularly the techno of the 80s and 90s, was, and this is a very broad sweeping claim, but it's largely built upon using the experience of alienation to tap into something of a kind of extraterrestrial, extra-human dynamic, or extra-human, extraterrestrial possibilities in black diasporic music. And so, you know, you got that famous line from Juan Atkins that he says, well, what we're trying to do is land a UFO on a record, right? And that's a really brilliant and neat way of defining the Detroit Techno Project, because it draws upon, you know, you've got all the allusions to science fiction cinema, music, in some sense the absurd, the speculative, all at work there, right? But you can definitely hear actresses using the impulses towards abstraction and alienation in those musics, but he's not interested in that kind of particular sci-fi dynamic. And so what I was trying to say is, think about it, is what is it that he's able to do and what is it that he's done here that takes the, again, the kind of something like the structural elements of those musics, but reformulates them, turns them into something new. And yeah, if you Get Over Ill was the album which exemplified that for me, because he was very determinedly saying that it was about walking around a place, a particular environment, and a very specified environment. And so, yeah, I wanted to use that as, again, a kind of productive tension to say, well, it is, in some sense, has a relation to Detroit techno, but you can't reduce it to an understanding of the kind of classic Detroit sound and the classic Detroit ethos. He's doing something very different here. And I tried to use that as a kind of animating force in the chapter, to go, well, it is this, but it's not quite that. And how do we pay attention to what it is the music, his music's saying, and also what he's saying, because he's quite forthcoming in putting forward kind of interpretations of his own music. So if we pay attention to what he's saying, how do we remain faithful to that and try and kind of draw out what it is that makes Get Over Ill unique? Yeah, I think he does something really interesting. I think the album does something really interesting with ideas of surveillance. So one way to, let's just say, like from the 1990s onwards, in a city like London, what starts to happen is, you know, a changing of what someone like Stuart Hall would have called in the 70s the colony culture, the particular or colony life that had developed in London in kind of concentrated areas of post-colonial settlement in the city. And in the 90s, that had started to change, you know, due to the very fact that populations change over time, and also due to the reorganization of the city. And you start to, you know, have this development in surveillance, which changed the way policing works. You know, obviously, policing still works in its overtly kind of violent and oppressive ways, but the nature of that violence and oppression shifts and takes on a particular technological manifestation through some various forms of surveillance activity. And one way you could look at that is to say, well, you know, that the means to survey people racialized as black, or people seen as racialized people seen as threats to the social order in various forms, is to see that as a new form of kind of top-down oppression, which flattens and stultifies the capacities of people to live. And that's, and again, going back to the urban sociology case, that's a perfectly legitimate set of claims to make. That stuff is real, you know, it does happen. What I was trying to get at with, what I think Getterville's kind of getting at is that it tries to both give a sense of what the grind of that form of surveillance feels like, but it also tries to show the persistence of, put it this way, that there wouldn't be need for surveillance if people didn't keep on evading and disrupting and rendering surveillance unrecognizable, should we say, and dysfunctional. And I think what actors are trying to do in Get Over Ill is both give and simultaneously, in the very textures of the music, give an account of what their experience of that type of stultifying kind of surveillance is like, but also what it is that keeps that surveillance trying to chase those forms of social life in the city. What it is that means that life is constantly escaping, reformulating, improvising in ways which render surveillance kind of inoperable. And I think that's at the heart of the album. I think what he's saying here is that, I think actually that, you know, I have a lot of respect for a lot of the work I do in this book wouldn't be possible without me borrowing from the work of music journalists who go out and not only interview artists, but also, you know, responding to the music as it comes out. But often in the immediate reviews of actresses Get Over Ill, there's a tendency to play up the, let's call it, the dystopian dynamics of the album. And I just felt that was a little bit dissatisfying. If you listen to what he's saying, also, I think if you listen to what the album is expressing and conveying, there's something else other than a flat, deadening dystopia. I mean, the very fact that the album exists tells you that there is not, that this is not a flat, deadened dystopia, right? The fact that it's made is already saying that it's challenging that claim. So I just wanted to kind of expand and develop that idea and say, well, what is it then in this album, which at points does sound quite bleak, but then in other moments it doesn't. And one way I try to think about it was that, well, rather than thinking of, let's say, the tracks as distinct units, you could think of, let's say, a particular track which has this kind of grinding, kind of crushing churn to it. You could think about it as a zoomed in moment of another particular track which appears to have this lightness and freshness, right? So what he's done is taken a millisecond of that kind of track with a lighter feel and zoomed in on it and amplified a particular millisecond, and what you hear is this grind and crush. Or you could flip that around the other way, that what that grind and crush as a kind of a wide panoramic view of a so-called dystopian landscape is, if you zoom in on it on a microsecond, you hear this kind of this, you know, that particular track where you hear this voice, this kind of computerized voice crying out like, don't stop the music. And I think if you listen to the album in that way, as this kind of almost like a set of a refracted kind of hall of mirrors type proposition, rather than a strict narrative like cinematic depiction of a landscape, that I think it becomes more interesting.
And that bit of the chapter kind of points to maybe the, I suppose, sometimes the paucity of the tools that we have with which to speak about music, because speaking about music's hard, and the fact that there's a tendency towards the cinematic or the visual, which sometimes is a bit of a disservice to work like this. And so then moving on to the chapter about grime, which is probably the most well-known of the three musics that you explore. What do you mean when you say that antagonism is the primary mode of grime and it's a question of antagonisms plural?
To be honest with you, I wasn't entirely sure. I was just trying to work out, like, once I'd written the bulk of the chapter, I was like, what is it that's going on here? What is it that I'm trying to get at? And I get to it at the end of the chapter, which I leave it quite open, is to say, well, it seems to be that in some sense, grime is, an understanding of grime is overdetermined through its relationship to policing and an idea of violence, right? That it seems to be that grime is often only understood through its relationship to a kind of warfare with the state. But by the same measure, you go, well, what would grime sound like if it didn't have that warfare going on? Would grime still need to exist if there wasn't that type of warfare going on, right? With a state apparatus looking to crush the very conditions that make the music possible. So I guess I was trying to say that is that there seemed, in one sense, that I always got the impression that despite the writing and the thinking about grime, that the artist didn't seem to like the state was an incidental factor, or the police were an incidental factor in their music making, right? That it was something going on in the background. There was something else at work here, and I guess I was trying to pose that question. Can we work? Is there something else at work here, or is it not? If there is, what could that possibly be? What is this other type of antagonism at work here? And I'm not saying I come close to any answer. I'm still like kind of puzzled myself, and I think that's actually what makes the music kind of fascinating and gives it that drive and that energy. You know, it's perfectly fine to listen to it through the lenses of kind of, in air quotes, resistance. But I think, again, that does the music a disservice if you only think about it in terms of the horrific things that the state has done to young black people in British cities since, you know, again, the 90s onwards. I think the music is about more than that. I mean, my intuition is the music is about more than that. That might be a failed intuition, but yeah, I was trying to unpack that and trying to see if it was possible to separate the two out. And unfortunately, I'm not entirely sure if it is. And what's interesting at present is that, you know, grime has now been surpassed as the cutting edge musical project of young black people or young people in urban environments in Britain. It's drill now. And that kind of chaining together of policing and music seems to be even more intense in the context of drill, which, you know, would be something worth thinking about.
It was the grime chapter and then thinking about the context of drill as well, which made the argument that you make throughout about kind of avoiding superficial realism or representational readings of these musics. You know, I think it is such a overwhelming in the kind of popular narratives to read grime as being in some ways hyper representative. So I found that really interesting. And then you talk specifically about kind of claustrophobia and localism and inequality as being quite energizing within this music. And you draw this out when you discuss the track Pow by Lethal Bizzle from 2004. And how does a tune like this not only kind of describe social circumstances of grime, but actually, in your words, you say it creates territory, which I thought was a neat phrase.
Yeah, I mean, it's compressed, compacted in so many ways. There's so much piled into Pow that it seems like it's each time you hear it, you're like, how is it possible for this to function? How is it possible for this to exist? There's firstly, like, I think it might be like 8 or 9 MCs in the space of 4 minutes. Each are delivering a kind of each, even on their own, in their own particular moment of their 8 bars of performance, are delivering kind of like line after line of ammunition. And the rhythm itself is just this kind of, I think, you know, I think it's actually Simon Reynolds who I quote says it's kind of like a whirling mania, I think, or something along those lines that he says about the track, that it's a kind of screaming kind of mania of a track that is just kind of wheeling around and around in this kind of screeching intensity. And yeah, I think if all this energy and all this population is—it's so overpopulated, Pow, that it seems implicit in it. It seems to be a demand for space, right? It seems to be a demand to go, oh, look, we're gonna—if you're gonna compress us into a particular geography, and not only after you compress us into a particular geography, you're gonna compress our very movement and our ability to live together and build lives together in this compacted territory. Is that we're gonna compact this song with even more material than you can handle, and then implicit in that is that it's gonna create so much pressure, so much overload that you're gonna have to give us some space, you're gonna have to give us some breathing room. I think that's what's, at least that's what I try and suggest, is that's what's at work in Pow. The way that the track seems to kind of burst at the seams, is that it appears to try to be burst at the particular limits that are enforced on those who are making the music. Well, colony culture is a term that comes up in Police in the Crisis, and that Stuart Hall wrote with, the names of everyone in that book, and it's like Chaz Critchter, and anyway, it's a book that came out of an early period of the Center of Contemporary Cultural Studies, and what they're trying to do in that is give an account of how, in the context of a growing state and police repression of black communities in Britain, how those communities were seeking to, in that confined space, build forms of economic, social, cultural existence that were autonomous and independent of those set of restrictions. And then base culture is a term that comes from, or was coined by Lynt and Kwesi Johnson to describe the particular nature of the cultural activity that took place in those colony zones, which is built around the culture of the sound system, and built around the particular, say the you know, a scientific improvisation with the effects of bass lines on people, physically and psychically, you could say, through this idea of, you know, the dread of the music, the dread effect of bass music. And again, if you go back to the one of the earlier chapters where I say, you know, house, techno and jungle were the kind of structural structural conditions which then kind of reformulated, played out in different ways in footwork, grime and the music of actress. one you could say in the particular case of Grime is that Grime is using the conditions of colony culture and base culture in new settings and new conditions. And it may not sound like it in an overt or obvious way, but if you start to think about it through those lenses, you can see a level of continuity and reworking, continuity in a kind of the bits they've rejected and the bits they've taken on and developed.
So you've been really generous with your time, and we've covered some of the book, but I would say to listeners that, you know, if we've kind of scratched the surface here, it's got so much, for quite a slim volume, it's got so much going on. So we've just kind of covered some of the basics here. I was going to ask, what would you say would be a few like key tracks or videos that anyone listening should check out to get a sense of any of these musics?
It's a good one, actually. For Grime, I would say check out almost any pirate rip from like 2003 or 2002, 2004 by like Wiley, particularly the Wiley Sidewinder sessions. They'd be a great place to start. They're kind of almost, you could argue, in some sense, the one of the birth points of Grime. With Actress, I mean, there's a set of albums out there. I think a good way into Actress is the album Splash, where the second S is spelt with a Z. And with Footwork, again, that's tough. I would say go for DJ Rashad's Just a Taste Volume 1. I think a mixtape that he put out when he's kind of coming into prominence as a Footwork producer and DJ in Chicago. They'd be good starting points, I think.
Great. I'll try and remember to put them in the show notes for any listeners. And then finally, what are you working on now?
Don't know. Let me think. We just had a child arrive in our lives, so at the moment I'm working on that at the moment, or trying to work on that, or help my partner work on that. But yeah, I'm at present, I'm trying to work more. I'm trying to get out of the single authored stuff or stuff I write on my own. And really the book, to call it something that's, you know, I take claim for all the faults in it, but anything that's good in the book is really out of a result of conversations and friendships with several people. And so I'm trying as much as possible, or I'm pretty determined as much as possible to work collectively or with other people as much as I can in anything I put out there research-wise. And so what I'm doing at present is there's a book that myself and a former colleague from Goldsmiths, Luis Moreno, have been working on for a while. It looks at three cities, really, I say, in the 1970s, early 1980s, Kingston in Jamaica, Detroit, and New York. And what we're interested in is how there's a period in the 70s where each of those cities appears to become critical to this various crises in capitalism going on at the moment, at that particular moment in time. But at the very same time, what arises in those cities are really kind of speculative projects of Black musical experimentation. In the case of Kingston, is dub. In the case of Detroit, there's funk, the P-Funk project. And in New York, you get the invention of hip-hop. And so we're working on something like that, like trying to rethink a kind of a set of arguments about the political economy of the 70s through those musical projects. With Ash Sharma, another friend, good friend, a couple of years ago, we published an article which kind of looked back at the Black British Cultural Studies project in New Formations, and kind of try to do a survey of that work and kind of construct a kind of an intellectual narrative about how Black British cultural studies came into being, and then situate that work within the contemporary context. And I think we're going to start on a follow-up article of sorts, which takes as a starting point the Steve McQueen, Small Axe series. And finally, I mean, it's something I'm trying to talk about as much as possible in public, so it kind of forces me to get it started, is for a long time, and I during lockdown, during that kind of pause in, you know, time, space, everything that happened in lockdown for a short period before things started to somehow get back into motion again, despite still being under lockdown conditions. I've been wanting to put something together on Gil Scott-Heron. And so I've got a notebook going, and I scribble down anything that comes to mind or when I have a moment or two. So that might be much longer, a longer term project. You know, it might never appear. It might appear in different guises. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm up to at the moment. Besides, you know, the usual of teaching and trying to ensure that, you know, people get fair pay and pensions for the work they do, under the guise of, you know, under these conditions of oppressive employment that we have in universities at the moment.
Well, all of that plus a young baby sounds like quite a lot to be getting on with. So
yeah.
Well, yeah. Busy. Thanks very much for your time and thanks for coming on the show.
No worries, Gamo. Thanks a lot.